3 minutes, Your Honor.
All right, you may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the Court, I'm Alex West with the Virginia Department of Labor and Industry and Special Assistant Commonwealth Attorney in this case. This is an enforcement action of a Virginia Occupational Safety and Health, or VOSH, regulation, and the main issue on appeal is interpreting the key language in a cited regulation that says, quote, could create a hazard. In other words, an obstructed forklift aisle that could create a hazard. First one to highlight, this is an appeal from a granting of a motion to strike where the reasonable doubt should be, as to sufficiency, should be resolved in the plaintiff's favor.
Would the injury play any role in our interpretation of the statute here?
I would say that it plays a very small role once the court has properly interpreted the regulation could create a hazard.
I mean, you put on a lot of evidence about the injury at trial, and you sought to admit a report that dealt with the injury, but the regulation, of course, doesn't require an injury.
Correct. I would say that we wouldn't necessarily have to. If there had been no injury at all, there still would have been a violation of this standard.
But what does the word could mean? That's a pretty broad term and can be pretty vague. So how do you suggest we construe the word could?
Well, the employer's position, and essentially adopted by the circuit court, is that we have to show an actual injury caused by an actual obstruction.
But you just got through saying that doesn't matter, does it?
Correct. And our position, what they would say our position is any obstructed aisle any obstruction in the aisle is a violation of this regulation.
Where do you see the trial court said that there has to be an actual injury?
It was in the opinion letter. I could dig in and find it. But basically, I believe it was almost those words. The court found that.
I think the court said there has to be an actual hazard, but not an actual injury.
Sure, but
there was an injury here, so we certainly have an injury. So.
And that is why that fact is important, but it's not determinative.
I wanted to ask some background questions. I was looking at Plaintiff's Exhibit 3 at JA 347. It's a picture of the forklifts coming out of the aisle. Did the injury occur in that area?
JA 347. Yes, Your Honor. The injury occurred approximately where this photograph was taken. I believe on the left side of that frame.
Okay.
They're actually rendering aid to him.
I see. And I see pallets in the foreground and pallets in the background. Am I right in seeing in this picture there's no room for the forklift to turn around?
There was no room to turn around. I believe the safety director testified that it could not have been, this task could not have been done in reverse.
And the aisle was only several feet wide between the pallets, right?
Correct. It was only wide enough for the body of the forklift itself, not for the 18-foot-long rails being carried. The analogy I would use is, it's not perfect here because the tables are low, so I'll say if I was carrying a golf clubs to the back row of an airplane, I would have to raise them into my line of vision.
So the commissioner didn't argue in this case that the aisle posed a hazard because the forklift couldn't turn around, right?
I think that might have been part. I think that would be part of the hazard. The hazard would be it could have caused an obstructed vision on the operator.
I wasn't seeing that argument in your opening brief. And I also didn't see the argument that it was a hazard because a pedestrian might have been or a worker might have been in the aisle at the same time as the forklift. You're not making that argument, right?
I think, I would say that we are. Because
I didn't see that argument in the opening brief.
I could look at that and find it.
The arguments that you're clearly making, one of them is that the hazard here is that a worker is more likely to get struck in the head rather than in the shins if the forklift is raised, right?
I disagree with that, actually, because that is what the circuit court said in their sort of their oral announcement of the ruling. It wouldn't matter where an employee was struck. The real hazard is that the obstructions caused this operator and necessarily caused this operator to raise these forks into his line of vision.
This is where the record kind of gets muddy for me because, as I understand it, everybody's referring to the mass of the forklift as being obstructing the vision. Now, you know, and the record's not crystal clear, but I actually have some familiarity. I used to operate a forklift when I was working my way through college. But the masts are the fixed rails that the forks go up and down in, I believe. And so it seems to me if the masts are obstructing your view, it's because of the angle of the forklift, not so much where the forks are either up or down. Now, if he'd said the load obstructed my view, that would be quite different. But but he said the mast obstructed his view, and it seems to me that's, you know, again, the record is pretty muddy, and I'm not sure I'm not going outside the record when I say that, but it seems to me that that the mast could obstruct your view just by how you position yourself in the, you know, behind the wheel of the forklift and where, how you've angled it, because you can, you know, it clearly goes up high enough to obstruct your view depending on, you know, which way you're looking and so forth. So that part of the record kind of confused me a little bit. And in connection with your legal argument, I take your legal argument that the court got it wrong in requiring that there, you know, be an actual hazard here. There might have been an actual hazard, but, you know, that's, you know, your argument is that's not what the statute says. But if that's not the case, then we have this word could cause, you know, an injury. And that's, you know, and that covers, the word could in isolation covers a whole lot of ground and is arguably pretty vague. Now, I know the federal regulations deal, they've sort of restricted that a little bit in their analog to this, to reasonable, I think it's reasonable foreseeability or language to that effect. But I don't know that you argued that on brief or below. So what, you know, again, I'm kind of confused by what your actual position here is.
So there are federal cases about this issue, and we've cited the two that are better for them. We cite Pharmasol Corporation, which is better for our position. But we essentially argue a middle ground here between any obstruction is a violation and we must prove an actual hazard occurred in this case because of this. We think there needs to be some tangible connection between the obstruction in the aisle and some hazard to an employee. We think we did show that in the evidence because
Can I just take you back, sort of riffing off of what Judge Humphrey said, there was testimony in the record that the visual obstruction was from the masts, which are there whether or not the forks are raised.
That is true.
So I'm having problems with seeing how that is an adequate hazard for you, for your case. But it seemed to me you had two other things you did raise below and in your opening brief. One was the greater injury to the head because the mass, the forks are raised. And the other was the overturning risk, which you cite at page 18 of your brief.
That is true. I would say that that's not the mast is not the only hazard. If the operator had not, hypothetically, had not raised the rails at all as he approached this area, the rails would have struck the pallets and it would have been a hazard to himself and others. Now, that's hypothetical,
but it's certainly axiomatic to me that if you position a load in such a way you can't see, that certainly, you know, is a high risk of a hazard.
Correct.
You
know,
if you literally can't see where you're going as a result of, but if you can't see where you're going because of something that, you know, that is inherent in the machinery you're operating, that may be a different proposition.
That's correct, and I think the key here and the confusion lies in our evidence didn't determinatively show that his vision was obstructed in actual fact. But we argue we didn't have to show that. We didn't have to show that this actual injury was caused by this driver's vision actually being obstructed. In fact, it's just that the pallets could have created that hazard.
Can I take you back to my question about the greater risk of a head injury and the risk of the forklift overturning? I did not see the trial court address either of those in its motion to strike ruling. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct.
Why weren't those enough by themselves to get past the motion to strike?
I believe it should have been. I think that the universe of hazards that these pallets created.
So isn't that your best argument?
I would say it is. Okay. Untying the actual injury and what caused it from.
Okay. This. I wanted to ask you about the could create standard. And there's could create a hazard. So could seems to mean it doesn't actually have to cause the injury. It could cause an injury. Hazard also has a contingency notion in it, right? I mean, you could have an open fire pit with no railing. Somebody doesn't fall in, but that is a hazard, right? It doesn't mean that there has been an injury or will necessarily be an injury. Do you agree with me so
far? I do.
Okay. What is the standard that we should apply to that? Is it just a negligent standard, or does the regulation apply a more exacting level of conduct by the employer?
The regulation itself is silent on that, obviously, but it does. We would suggest that you look at whether there's a tangible risk created, some tangible connection between the obstruction and a hazard.
Is there a reasonableness requirement, like the law implies to, in many contexts, it has to be a reasonable risk?
I would suggest that would be appropriate. There is a case, there's a Second Circuit case dealing with a different OSHA actually regulation, and they adopt this so-called significant risk test as the Pratt and Whitney case, which I believe only they cited. However, that was a regulation that didn't have the word could in it. Mm-hmm. And so I would hasten not to adopt that. I don't want the court to adopt, because I believe that does misread could as well. Could does not mean there's a significant risk of a hazard.
Can I take you to the 2:407 issue on the remedial measure question? In preparing for this argument, we discovered there are actually three rules that different courts apply. One is the rule that you cited that says that you redact from the document the remedial measures and admit the factual admissions that go to culpability. Another rule is it all stays out. And then the third rule from the Kentucky Supreme Court is, you know, if the measures are implemented, then you keep it, the whole thing out. And if they're not, then presumably it can come in. But every case is case by case. Which of those three rules should we adopt?
I would adopt the position that if there is something excisable from the, in this case, the report and the evidence that's being proffered, that it can, if it can be redacted or not admitted, there is important information that is not a subsequent remedial measure in the report. I think it would be more appropriate to allow it in that case.
Going to Plaintiff's Exhibit 8, can you point to me on page, I think this is page 397 of the Joint Appendix, which paragraphs in here do you say should have come in under your rule?
Should not have come in?
Should have come in.
Should have come in. The paragraphs, all the ones that are listed under causes, basic and root causes, so the almost
you're
the entirety.
Not, you're, of not, you're not seeking anything under on page 397 after corrective actions. You're saying that all could have been redacted.
I would suggest that that would have, and that was what we offered at the trial.
And what's your best example of something on page 397 that you say should have come in that supports culpability?
I would say the conclusions in the report about the operator having raised his load higher than necessary.
Is that the first paragraph?
That is the first. And then that Mr. Greer, their conclusion was Mr. Greer violated his training by not lowering the load, which goes to a conclusion that they obviously made that there was a hazard associated with what happened. Now, they're arguing that in terms of an employee misconduct defense, which, of course, never became, it was a motion to strike, so they never got to present it, and we have arguments against that, but it's on remand, it would be appropriate. But it would be a conclusion that would rebut their argument that there really was no hazard created by the obstruction.
So the remedy that you're seeking here, you want us to reverse and remand this for further proceedings?
I think the court would have to do that because, A, the defense never put on evidence. This was mm-hmm. just after our evidence, and it would hopefully be with instructions about the proper interpretation yeah. of
so the regulation. So if they thought, you know, there really was no risk of the forklift overturning because these things were so light, they could put that evidence on?
I suppose they could, and the court could make that conclusion. We would think that would be an error of fact rather than law at that point, but yes.
Let me follow up. We're getting your rebuttal time, and I'll give you some extra time, but you, Judge, I just raised a question in my mind. With respect to the redacting the report, the report, though, focuses on the injury, does it not? Not on the hazard. So, granting your point that perhaps a redacted version of the report would be admissible, I guess then we get to the relevance issue, which is, you know, since it focuses on the injury rather than the cause of the injury, you know, is that admissible under that theory? In other words, what's the relevance of it to, you know, if we're saying it doesn't matter about an injury, that's not the point. The point is the obstruction and its potential for, you know, causing an injury. What's the relevance of the report?
The relevance would be only that, and this goes to the prior question, the fact of what actually happened here is a factor. It's not determinative of the existence of the hazard that could have been created.
It's an admission of culpability, isn't it?
It is an admission that there was a hazard. Because culpability in this context doesn't truly matter. It's not a negligence case, so it's not really saying, well, they're the cause of this accident.
I thought you indicated earlier that in order to satisfy the could create a hazard standard, it has to be at least negligence. Or at most negligence. I was trying to get, what is the standard?
But right. I mean,
it seems like negligence would satisfy it.
I believe it could, I mean, I believe the words I came up with, and they're not snappy, are the tangible connection between the obstruction and the hazard. And in a way, that doesn't even consider the negligence or culpability of putting the obstruction there. It's just this obstruction could create this
hazard. Well, the circuit court's ruling here is not exactly a model of clarity. I'll certainly make that point. But it seems to me that what it did here was equate the word hazard with the word injury.
Sure.
And everybody sort of took that, and you know, to be honest, I think there's your evidence contributed to that equation there by the circuit court. And I think the focus here legally is on the potential, not on the actual result, I guess. And so, again, I get back to this notion of what's in the report. Can you point specifically to what's in the report that relates to the, the could have posed a hazard language in the regulation?
Other than the existence and the occurrence of the injury being evidence that it could have,
right.
that state of affairs could have caused a hazard.
Would you also include Appendix 399, the photograph with the description in there? It says, stack of material Mr. Greer raised and load above to clear before reaching the rack prior to the incident. Load needs to be raised approximately 30 inches to safely clear balance.
That's correct, and that is from their report.
That's part of the report, though, right?
It is. It's okay. A photograph with a caption from their report.
Yeah, got it.
And I would point out, in the Pharmasol case, the parties entered into a stipulation that the actual injury did not matter in that case. It was inadmissible. We did not do that. And part of it is because we felt that what actually happened here was somewhat important. It wasn't just ephemeral sort of what could have happened.
Sorry. Can I ask?
Go ahead, Mark. Sure.
Is there any dispute here that employees had access to this area?
I don't believe there is.
Is there any dispute that the employer knew that the pallets were in the aisles?
I believe that the court concluded that there was employee access and there was employer knowledge, and there was no cross appeal. So I don't believe so.
Thank you, Mr. Vance.
Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Travis Vance with Fisher and Phillips, and we represent the appellee Utility Trailer Manufacturing Company. Just one point. There in that discussion, the judge actually didn't address the third and fourth elements of an OSHA citation. So there's four elements. There's got to be a standard on point and a violation of the standard. Then there has to be knowledge of the violative condition, and there has to be access to that condition.
You didn't move to strike on those grounds, failure to show that.
Well, the judge in the final order actually didn't address those third and fourth elements.
That wasn't part of your motion to strike, though, was it?
Correct. The motion to strike was focused on the standard. I think it's to Judge Humphrey's point, it's good to look at the context of this standard. Okay, the mast is on every forklift in the Commonwealth.
I wanted to just cut to the legal standard.
Right.
This is really the heart of the first assignment of error. If you agree, I take it, that there doesn't have to be an injury for there to be a violation.
That's correct.
Right? There doesn't have to be an actual injury, right?
Correct.
There has to be an actual hazard.
Correct.
And do you agree that actual hazard, what standard governs that? Is it a negligence standard? What's your position on that?
Well, it's the actual standard itself. There's no negligence standard in OSHA cases. It's just those four elements that they have to show.
Well, I mean, suppose an employer left a window open and a fly flew in.
Correct.
And distracted the forklift operator and he drove into a worker.
Right.
No one would think that having the window open could create
Correct.
A hazard, even though hypothetically it's possible. There's some. It's got to be some notion of reasonableness. So
yeah.
What is this? What should the standard be?
Yes, John, it has to be a recognized hazard that the employer had actual or constructive knowledge. And I think that's the closest. It's not negligence, but it's akin to negligence.
And having pallets in the aisle such that you can't turn the forklift around, it can only move in one direction, that seems kind of hazardous.
Well, this standard is a housekeeping standard. Mm-hmm. Let's take a step back. It's a housekeeping standard. It addresses the travel of the forklift. Okay, so the load is not the forklift. The forklift is, if you look at even the Pharmasol case, Judge Phillips, who I know very well, Judge Phillips talks about the obstructions in the actual aisleways created the hazard. Here, at trial, the commissioner says it's the mast. The mast doesn't create anything.
I understand that, but like the cases that you cite, General Motors Corporation and
Baker,
those involve really wide aisles. I think in General Motors Corporation, it was a 20-foot wide aisle.
Correct.
And the ALJ said, you know, something extending 22 inches into that 20-foot aisle doesn't create a hazard. here, it's a 3-foot aisle with the pallets obstructing the aisle.
But if you look at the file, Your Honor, there's actually they put a rack in that aisleway so that nobody can put pallets inside of that space, and then they remove it with the forks, set it to the side, and then they drive it in there. That's how they keep it clear. Now, to Judge Humphrey's point, this case is all about the mass. The mass is static. It doesn't create anything. The pallets don't create the mass.
No, and I think you've got a strong argument on that. What troubles me are the references to the risk of the forklift overturning and the comparative danger of somebody being struck in the head. And I do not see that the trial court's opinion addressed that issue on the motion to strike. And taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the commissioner, why isn't that reversible error?
Well, it's not reversible error because, as a matter of law, they didn't prove the four elements that they have to require to prove.
Whoa. The issue is, does it create a hazard? There was testimony from Mr. Farmer that it did create a hazard for the two reasons I mentioned, specifically overturning risk, which he said was the greater risk, and the other one was getting hit in the head. The trial court's opinion doesn't address either of those. That seems like error.
But you don't, on a motion to strike, if it doesn't, it defies logic or common sense, you can ignore it. And here, Mr. Farmer's testimony was the mast create a hazard.
You keep going to the mast, but there were these other two items of danger in the record also that you're not addressing.
But our position is at trial, Mr. Farmer abandoned the pallets. He abandoned the parts and the floor.
Where did he abandon the two risks that I mentioned?
Well, it's an obstruction. It's not the risk that is required.
That wasn't my question. Where does Mr. Farmer, in the record, abandon the overturning risk or the risk of?
I don't remember him affirmatively abandoning that, Your Honor. Having tried the case with Mr. West, I don't remember that even being a part of the case in chief. It was all about the visual obstruction.
I mean, it's cited in the opening brief in the commissioner's brief at page 18.
And I think another thing to remember about this standard, not only is it housekeeping, but the issues with the mast and visual obstruction are addressed by a different standard. So that's why this standard was not violated. If you look at the 29 CFR 1910, that's the general industry standards. 19176 is a housekeeping standard that includes keeping safe clearances for material equipment.
So that they don't create a hazard.
Correct. 1910-178 addresses the actual forklift operation, including visual operations. So if there is a load in front of someone that's creating a visual observation, that's directly addressed by a different standard. And what does that mean here from statutory interpretation is that 176 doesn't address that standard because it's addressed elsewhere.
This record is murky, to say the least, as far as I'm concerned. But do I understand your argument correctly, following up on Judge Raphael's points, that because the focus was on the mast rather than, and while there's testimony about possible overturning of the forklift if you raise the load too high and it's too heavy and so forth, overbear. But the focus generally was on the mast, and the court, is it your position, the court essentially based its ruling on the fact that the mast is being in the nature that it was, immovable, necessarily could not have created a hazard?
I think the court made its decision based on the fact that the pallets did not create an actual hazard, which included any sort of visual obstruction, because Mr. Farmer testified, even though he raised the load to go over the pallets, that he could still see, and that the only potential hazard was the mast.
If the regulation essentially means that, as the court concluded, that it required the creation of an actual hazard.
Correct.
Couldn't the regulation have just said simply that instead of
correct.
Could? The
it,
word
it,
could
it could have said that, Your Honor.
They chose the word could, which is a much more nebulous word than, say, would.
Right. But if you take a step back and look at the entire standard, it says use of mechanical equipment, where mechanical handling equipment is used, sufficient safe clearances shall be allowed for aisles at loading docks, through doorways, and wherever turns or passage must be made, referring to the actual operation of the forklift. Then it says aisles and passageways shall be kept clear and in good repair with no obstructions across or in aisles that can create a hazard. And if you look at the General Motors case, they did a fantastic job of dissecting that from a statutory interpretation standpoint. And even though in the Anchor Hocking case agreed with, and in General Motors it says when the words shall be kept clear or are interested in their proper context, it is clear that that only those obstructions which create a hazard are prohibited. The standard permits obstructions as long as they create no hazards.
Well, certainly with a forklift, if you've got something, you know, that's off to one side, you could raise your load over it, and you know, it arguably is not a hazard if you can continue on your path by simply raising the load as long as it doesn't
Correct.
Provide any. But if you have to raise, if the obstruction is so high that you have to, this gets to Judge Raphael's points, if you have to raise the load so high that it, you know, overcomes the point of balance and the forklift goes, you know, head over heels, well, then clearly that was a hazard in retrospect.
But that hazard you're articulating, Judge Humphreys, is not it's not considered, it's not part of this standard. The visual obstruction is 1910.178(n)(4). The last sentence says, if the load being carried obstructs forward view, the driver shall be required to travel with the load trailing. So that standard addresses visual obstructions. 176, which was the case before the trial court, addresses the footprint of the forklift. It's a housekeeping standard.
Yeah.
Keep boxes
I'm
out of the way. That's
finding,
what it means.
I'm having trouble finding that persuasive with the plain language of 176A. It says, aisles and passageways shall be kept clear and in good repair with no obstruction across or in aisles that could create a hazard. I mean, that seems like the core of what they're arguing.
That is, Your Honor, but if you look at the whole standard, 176B, secure storage of material,
right.
176C,
but
housekeeping.
Your client's charged with a violation of A.
That's correct, but if you look at statutory interpretation, what does 176 apply to? It applies to housekeeping. What's in the floor so that a forklift can get around it? Visual obstruction is the operation of the forklift accounted for in a different standard.
Can I take you to the 407 issue?
Sure.
Am I right in reading your brief as you're not really defending the trial court's ruling on 407? You're arguing that the report was properly excluded on hearsay grounds?
Well, as a threshold matter, Your Honor, the commissioner never laid the proper foundation for hearsay, so the judge made the right decision.
I didn't see you defend the 407 ruling in your brief.
Well, we're not abandoning it because it was at the trial court level. We made the argument.
So we've given you an opportunity with the Thomas case to tell us which of the three rules I mentioned earlier, which of those rules should apply.
It should be excluded in its total. Here's why, Your Honor. You know, I do OSHA litigation all over the country, and you don't ever see OSHA just take the defendant's investigation file and make it theirs. And that's what OSHA did here in this case. All right, so think about it from a public policy standpoint. If utility trailer does its own investigation, has all these different things that it's going to do, in fact, doing the investigation is a subsequent remedial measure in itself. So
well,
why would any employer
in the suppose the investigation finds there was negligence and recommends three remedial actions and none of them are taken?
Yeah, but I know that wasn't the case here.
No, but that's why it's called a hypothetical. I mean, suppose
Correct.
They weren't taken.
Right. I mean,
why wouldn't that come in?
But the actual going through it, I mean, there's so many different things that could happen. If they put it in the paper, maybe manager says we treated somebody else a different way. There's all kinds of different things. And even if it comes in, there was no foundation for hearsay. Well, what about hearsay with hearsay?
Well, I mean, it seems like it was an admission by your agent within the scope of his employment. So I'm not real persuaded on
the
hearsay.
But you have to lay the foundation for that, Your Honor. The foundation for that was not laid.
I thought his title and responsibility was in the record.
But is it within his responsibility to do an investigation? That was never in the record. You can't jump to that conclusion.
Let me go back to the 407 question. Virginia Rule of Evidence 2:407 says, when, after the occurrence of an event, measures are taken, which, if taken prior to the event, et cetera. If measures aren't taken, does that exclusion apply?
And you mean by that is...
If no remedial measures are actually taken with the report...
Potentially, Your Honor, but I know in this case it never became an issue with the trial court, but I can tell you that was not the case here.
Yeah.
And if you look at going back to the house, it's a housekeeping standard. Keep things out of the way of the forklift. That's what we did. We had a rack there. It's in the record. There's a picture of that rack. They moved the rack so there's sufficient safe clearance. It doesn't address the load. It doesn't address visual obstruction. And you know why? Because it's addressed elsewhere. So there was no violation of 176A in this case, and the trial court made the correct decision.
Back to Raphael's question about the report. I know, you know, with all due respect about you doing OSHA litigation all over the country, I know the First Circuit at least has held with respect to subsequent remedial measures that it's just the subsequent remedial measures that are not admissible, not the factual findings that underlie them.
Right, and it's very rarely litigated, Your Honor, to that point. Generally, when that comes up, that it just doesn't come in for a variety of different reasons.
But that seems like the majority rule, which Judge Humphrey said, is you sever it. The remedial measures are redacted, and the factual admissions come in.
Well, that's assuming it gets in through the other rules of evidence, which is not the case here.
We're focused right now on 407. Correct. I get that you've got a hearsay argument.
Yeah, I mean, with 407, I think that you have to start on erring on the side of keeping it all out. And the reason for that is the public policy argument. Because if you allow Virginia OSHA to go into an employer in the Commonwealth and take their investigation file and turn it into theirs, then why, from a public policy standpoint, would any employer do their investigation?
Let me ask you the same question I asked your opponent, which is, you know, if we get past the admissibility of this report based on hearsay and subsequent remedial measures, the question that still remains, at least for me, is the relevance of it, because it seems to me that report focuses on the causes of the injury as opposed to focusing on the potential
That's a good point, and it goes back to, we made a relevance objection. It goes back to my point of, this is Virginia OSHA, the Commissioner of Labor, it's their case in chief. They have the burden to prosecute this. So what we do to address the injury and discipline of that employee is not relevant to the commissioner's case. In fact, if you look in we tried to get some...
Well, hang on. But there's no question that discipline wouldn't come in. That would be excluded under 407. The issue is whether other factual statements would
come in. It would come in on our rebuttal and our defense, because we alleged employee misconduct. So one of the things you have to show employee misconduct is that you discipline employees who violate safety rules. But if you look, it's telling. In the final order, on page 2, Judge Rolette actually struck out a provision about the safety policies, that we take steps to ensure that they're operating them safely and that we discipline the employees. And that's because he thought it wasn't relevant.
Well, it seems to me, and you know, maybe it's a close issue, I don't know, but at the trial level, the commissioner didn't seem to articulate, at least in the record to me, it didn't articulate the basis for admissibility of this report beyond the subsequent remedial measures argument that was made. But the report itself, correct me if I'm wrong, but the report itself, it seems to me, basically boils down to whether or not the elevated load caused this accident.
Right.
As opposed to whether or not the pallets partially in the you know, right of way, if you want to call
correct.
It that,
it doesn't, you know, address
the hazard.
Yeah, it doesn't address the elements that OSHA has to prove. That's the issue. I mean, there was an injury to one of their coworkers, and they want to figure out, how do we keep this from happening again? What do we need to do to you know, have it remedial right. measures? So,
thank you
very much, Your Honor.
Buttle?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that the very last thing the counsel said is the reason why employers do these investigations is because they want to know what caused injuries to their employees. And
well,
you know,
I mean, in fairness now, what we've got here, just Raphael pointed out earlier, we have a citation for a specific regulatory violation, which is whether or not there's a hazard in the workplace, essentially,
sure.
Or a potential hazard in the workplace. That's the focus. That's the citation. That's what has to be proven. It seems to me everybody sort of got off the rails here by focusing more on the injury that occurred. And as far as this report is concerned, the report almost exclusively focuses on the injury, and I'm not even sure it even really references much the fact that these pallets were, you know, where they were. I mean, admittedly, the photograph that's part of the report, you know, certainly speaks for itself. But in terms of the text of the report, I didn't see anything in there really that focused on the potential placement of the pallets, which are really what the citation was all about.
Certainly, they did not consider, obviously, the setup of those pallets and of that area to be a cause. But which would have made it more relevant, I will say. But
well, I was going to say, isn't that the relevance, though?
I do believe it's relevant, but only insofar as the injury, obviously the injury itself is somewhat relevant to whether this obstruction could create a hazard, in that one actually did happen, under circumstances that could have been caused by this obstruction.
But except the report says that the that the cause of the injury was not the obstruction, it was the elevated load.
It does, and so that was their
conclusion. But that's not the citation either.
That was their ultimate conclusion. I think part of that is based underlyingly upon the fact that their conclusion that raising a load into the line of sight of a forklift driver is a hazard or could create
a hazard. Mr. Vance says, if on the 407 question, if you admit portions of these reports, he's suggesting employers be deterred from doing the right thing and investigating accidents. What's your answer to that?
I think that employers really do them because they want to know what happened to their employees and to assess risk and workers' comp liability and many other things. And
you're saying they wouldn't be deterred?
I don't think they would be. I think employers will do that because I think the law actually is that we can use them to the extent there's no inadmissible content in them. And their conclusions about what caused an accident are not admissible in subsequent remedial measures grounds, which was ultimately the only actual ground the circuit court articulated as to the basis.
What's your response to his hearsay argument?
We believe we did lay a foundation, as Judge you articulated. We had the person who wrote the report was on the stand, and he was in
his
job title.
Was that his job title?
It's only admissible if it's under the party opponent exception, right?
Certainly, yes.
Okay, so the mere fact that he was employed in part of his job, as far as you're concerned, established the foundation.
It would.
Okay.
It would. If there was any hearsay within hearsay, we never got that far because I did, the ultimate ruling was simply that it contained subsequent remedial measures. So my time's expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, the case will be submitted. Again, we thank counsel for your argument, and the court will stand adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.